This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 84 was recorded on October 12th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. CPM Group founder Jeffrey Christian will be joining me as this week's feature interview guest. Jeff and I will discuss the U.S. dollar, gold, silver, base metals, who might be the next Fed chair, and how that will affect precious metals prices, Europe, Russia, China, and much more. Also, be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick and I will discuss gold trading strategies, extended crude oil market coverage, and the latest quarterly review from Hoisington's Dr. Lacey Hunt.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, that S&P 500, even though it's been powering higher for multiple weeks now, is slowly starting to meet overhead resistance. And it seems like every time it's breaking out, it's bumping its head. There's a little bit of overhead resistance there. What's your feeling here where the S&P 500 is going?
Yeah, you know, we actually closed red on the day today. I think that's the first time in a while. But still, you know, another all-time high yesterday. 2553.5 was the high print on the E-mini futures contract. And, you know, here we are, folks. It's mid-October. The market's not crashing like everybody predicted it would. And as we've predicted on this program, if there's one time that markets don't crash, it's when a whole bunch of people have predicted it and everybody is hedged. So I'm guessing that probably through year end, we're not going to have a market crash. All of the people, myself included, that bought S&P puts, expecting that there might be some end of 2017 market crash, will end up with those options expiring worthless. I wouldn't be at all surprised before 2018 is out if we have real fireworks in the market. And, you know, it's always possible it could start this year, but I don't see it as imminent the way some people have. Definitely a late stage bull market, crazy mania stage, but, you know, it can still go higher. I'm happy to be out of this market. If you want to play the upside, you know, think about using options to limit your downside exposure. And certainly, you know, there are plenty of people that understand where we are, that this is a mania, that this is a bubble, and bubbles are a way to make money if you know how to trade them. So if you have that perspective and you're good at that kind of trading and you know how you're going to get out ahead of the crowd, have at it. There's plenty of opportunity to make money in this market. But boy, I don't think this is a time to be putting new money to work in a buy and hold strategy, expecting to hold stocks over the long term and, you know, years from now you'll be better off. I really think we're in the late stages of a bull market. Maybe it has a month left to go. Maybe it has a year left to go. I don't know. I don't think anybody does. But I definitely think this is going to end badly.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar index. And really, the last 4 days, we've seen the dollar index kind of test the 94 handle very temporarily, and now it's been pulled back to actually temporarily trading below the 93 handle. Do you think that this is just a little short-term breather on the dollar index before it continues higher, or is that it for the dollar?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, Patrick, and frankly, neither do the people that are proclaiming the bounce to be over. I think they're jumping the gun. Look, it's true that we have broken the very, very short-term pattern of a progression of higher highs and higher lows, you know, on the very short-term time frame charts. But we've seen, what, a pullback of 1.5 on the dollar index here? As far as I'm concerned, we either need to see a close, a daily close on the dollar index above 98.5, which would be the 61.8 retrace level, or below 91, which would be a new low. That would call the trend. That would say, okay, you know, we can see what's going on here. Right now, we're seeing a little pullback. Is it going to turn into a big pullback and roll over below 91, or are we going to just power higher? Remember that this was FOMC minutes this week, so that had something to do with the weakness. I don't think there's enough data to really make a call here.
Eric, let's move on to oil. We continue to stay above $50 here on the level. What's your thinking about oil here?
Talk about a roller coaster week in oil, and particularly today on Thursday, a roller coaster day. Well, what happened is we had two inventory reports. EIA is the government inventory that normally comes out Wednesday morning, delayed till Thursday morning this week because of the holiday. API, American Petroleum Institute, comes out a day earlier, normally Tuesday afternoon, this week Wednesday afternoon. So what happened is API on Wednesday afternoon reports a massive 3 million barrel build on inventory, on crude oil inventory, and a very small drawdown in gasoline. That, of course, sent prices just ratcheting lower as people said, oh my God, a great big build on inventory, which really shouldn't be that much of a surprise this time of year. Prices all the way from 51 spot 40 down to 50 spot 20, so about $1.20 of downside between the API report and the EIA report. Then the EIA report comes out on Thursday morning, not saying a build of 3 million barrels like API, but almost the same number in the opposite direction, 2.7 million barrel drawdown on crude oil inventory. That would normally be very bullish, but the thing is that there was a build in inventory in Cushing, Oklahoma, which is very important to the West Texas Intermediate futures contract because that's where it settles, 1.3 million barrel build in Cushing. Gasoline inventories, Patrick, building 2.5 million barrels, whereas API had predicted a drawdown on gasoline inventories. So we definitely have the gasoline picking up, or piling up, I should say. Distillates, meanwhile, drawing down 1.4 million barrels. The market didn't know what to make of this. The initial reaction was very muted because traders were trying to balance, okay, pretty sizable drawdown on inventory, but wait a minute, really, really big, well beyond expectations, build on gasoline inventories. Which one's more important? What do we do? There was a fairly narrow consolidation range between 50 spot 20 and 50 spot 60. That lasted for about an hour or so. All of a sudden, there's a just with terrific volume and vigor, there's this massive rip higher as we broke out of that consolidation range, took us up to about 50 spot 88, where the bulls were all celebrating, and then all of a sudden, it ran out of steam, and the bears took control again. We retraced from 50.88 all the way down to 50 spot 15. That's below the low prior to the data coming out. Seemed like the bears were in control, and the market was crashing. Surely we were headed to $40 from here, and then all of a sudden it reverses again and rips higher right up to just about where it was before the inventory data came out, a little bit higher at 50 spot 67 as we're speaking, just coming into the close on Thursday afternoon. The way I interpret this roller coaster is the market can't decide who's in charge. We, I think, put in the top, the cyclical high here at 52 spot 88 last week. I think that we are headed down to at least 48 spot 40, maybe lower. Is it time to go down to that yet, or is there going to be another one last push up to 51.20 before? I think the market was just in a tug of war between the bulls and the bears all afternoon trying to sort that out. The answer is not in yet. It's a draw so far. Tomorrow's Friday the 13th. We'll see what happens. Meanwhile, we have a couple of interesting media reports out this week. Art Berman has an article, which is linked in your Research Roundup email, calling for higher prices by 2018. Meanwhile, our friend Raul Paul over at Real Vision has a new video out with a very, very bearish outlook, calling for WTI prices in the 20s. So two experts with radically opposing views. Which one's right? That's a longer discussion. Let's save that for the post-game segment after the feature interview with Jeff Christian.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, and I'm sure Jeffrey's going to have a few comments on this over here, but obviously last week we hit a low near the 1260 mark, and since we've been bouncing, almost hitting 1300 on the upside, is that it for the selling in gold, or where do you think we're heading?
Well, I want to save most of the gold conversation for Jeff Christian. Obviously is an expert in the field, knows a lot more about it than I do. 1262, that low print, does kind of have the looks, if I just look at the tape, like an exhaustion low. You know, it was a sudden sell-off, and then it very quickly recovered and has been just uphill ever since then. So did we all screw up if we failed to take advantage of that opportunity to buy below 1270? Or is there maybe even lower still to come? In my mind, the jury is still out until you have a solid opinion on the dollar, because I think if the dollar really resumes a secular uptrend above 103, gold is going to face some real headwinds. But in my mind, the jury is still out on the dollar. Let's ask Jeff Christian the same question when we get to the feature interview.
All right. And finally, let's just have a quick review of interest rates. That 10-year yield temporarily hit near 240 on the upside and has since pulled back to about 232. Do you think that's as far as interest rates are going to rise here, or is this going to continue?
You know, I really don't have a strong opinion on it. We are still in the middle of that trading range between 2 spot 12 and 2 spot 64 on the 10-year yield. My feeling had been that I look for a resolution to the downside in yield, upside in price, but I don't really have very strong conviction about that. Love to get Juliet DeClercq back on the program before the year is out to get her view, because she's had some really prescient calls on the 10-year yield. My feeling is we're right in the middle of this trading range. I don't really have a strong opinion.
All right. Well, thanks for that market wrap, Eric. For this week's featured interview, CPM Group founder Jeffrey Christian, a noted precious metals expert, will be joining us. Eric's interview with Jeffrey is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is CPM Group founder Jeffrey Christian. Jeff, obviously you're a precious metals guy. We're going to get to gold and silver in just a minute, but I want to start with the U.S. dollar, because obviously everything else is priced in the dollar. We had seen what a lot of people thought were going to be a long-standing secular bull run in the dollar index. The last several months, we've seen a big sell-off, and all of a sudden the bears are out. We've gone from record long speculative interest to record short speculative interest. So is the dollar rally over? Was this just a pullback that's set to continue? What's your outlook for the U.S. dollar?
Well, when we look at the dollar, because we don't get involved necessarily in, you know, shorter term trading of the dollar, we look at it more as a macroeconomic fundamental, and we look at it on a longer term basis. And our view was that, you know, the dollar did go through this very large upward ratcheting from 2015 through into 2016. And our view was that the dollar would basically move sideways with a slight upward bias in a relatively volatile fashion from, say, 2017 onward. So we're not supposed to see the dollar come off. We don't expect the dollar to continue to decline. We think it's pretty much, if you look at it on a trade-weighted basis, on the broad trade-weighted basis index, we think that you're pretty much close to the bottom of it. We don't necessarily see it continuing to rise at the rapid pace that we saw in 2015, 2016, but we don't necessarily look for it to go back to the lower levels that it had from, say, 2008 to 2014. So we're looking for it to move sort of sideways in a volatile fashion with an upward bias.
A trend that we've heard a lot about lately, although I'm not sure how much reality versus hype it is de-dollarization. And I think there's certainly, you know, some truth to this, that a lot of people would like to move away from the dollar. We see China and Japan with less U.S. Treasury holdings than they used to have. Do you think that this trend of de-dollarization is something that we should take seriously? Do you think that the U.S. dollar's hegemony as the world's reserve currency is in question at all?
I think that's a long-term transition. Most central bankers and most economists would like to see the world move to a multipolar currency regime where you don't have a dominant currency. No one necessarily wants their currency to be the dominant currency, except maybe the U.S. government, the dollar. The Chinese clearly don't want the yuan to be the dominant currency in the future. But I think a lot of people would like to see a multipolar currency regime. They see it as a long-term transition, and they see it as a long-term transition for a couple reasons. One reason is that there are so many dollars out there, and you have about 62% of central bank assets in U.S. dollars, and you have over 70% of private assets in U.S. dollar denominated assets. So the dollar has such an enormous pool that it's like the old joke, if you owe a bank enough, you own it. There's no ready, quick substitute away from the dollar to anything else, even to a pool of all the other currencies combined. You can't do it. So you have to have an extended period of time where the liquidity of other currencies increases relative to the liquidity of the dollar. And the other thing is you need to have radical changes in the money regulations within countries around the world, where you have to have not only the regulations changed to allow people to hold their assets in currencies other than their own domestic currency, but they also have to have a market infrastructure that allows them to do that. And that also is something that's going to take many decades to occur, if it's to occur at all. So you've got these two long-term prerequisites to moving away from the dollar. The dollar's hegemony is probably peaked, and it probably will decline from here, but it will probably decline very slowly. Now, there's a third proviso that has to be kicked in, which is, you know, one of the reasons for the dollar's hegemony over the last 80 years has been the relative strength and productivity of the U.S. economy relative to the rest of the world. And that is still very much in play. The rest of the world is growing economically relative to the United States. The United States in the 70s was, you know, close to 45-50% of world GDP. Today it's down to about 22% of world GDP as the rest of the world grows up around it, and a variety of long-term economic trends change the way the world works. But the U.S. still has all sorts of competitive advantages in terms of productivity, natural resources, rule of law, and that gives it an undue advantage against other economies. And that's reflected in the fact that the dollar has been the currency of choice, and that's been reflected in the fact that, you know, there are any number of investors around the world who want to invest in the U.S. economy, or they'll invest in financial markets through the U.S. financial markets, but not other markets. And so the third proviso that has to change for the dollar to really lose more status is that other countries have to become more competitive economically and more stable legally and regulatorily so that people feel comfortable holding their assets in their currencies.
Okay, with that framework in place, let's go ahead and move on to gold, a topic which you specialize in, and I'm sure everybody's dying to hear. What a roller coaster we've seen this week. Down testing 1262 was the low print, and then all the way back up to 1296. And as we're speaking on Wednesday afternoon, after the Fed minutes came out, we got a bounce back up to 1291 or so. Where do you see both short, medium, and long term? Where's gold headed from here?
We think that, you know, over the next few months, the price is probably going to move back up toward 1340, 1360, probably into late November and December before we get to those levels. But, you know, we're sort of looking at the gold price moving. We're sort of looking at it moving in a range between 1260 and 1360 over the next 3 months. And then getting into 2018, depending on what happens in the global financial markets, we think that the gold price will probably continue to rise at perhaps a slightly faster rate than it has risen in the last couple of years.
So that 1260 was definitely an opportunity to buy for anybody who missed it, or for those listeners who got it, congratulations. How about silver? You know, obviously there's this ongoing debate about whether silver is an economic or an industrial metal. Where do you see silver going, and particularly with its relationship to gold?
I think silver's got a firm base around 1620, but I think it also has a firm ceiling around $18.50 or $19 over the next several months. So, you know, we're looking for silver to move sideways. I mean, silver is a financial asset to some extent, like gold, but it's much more of an industrial metal and an industrial commodity. And in some ways, it trades more like gold than it does industrial commodities, but in other ways, it trades more like an industrial commodity like copper, oil, or platinum than it does like gold. And I think that that'll weigh on silver going forward. You know, one of the things that you see is that investment demand really drives prices higher or lower, and investors are much more focused on gold right now, it seems, than they are on silver.
I think the last time we had you on the program, you described by 2020 or so a target upwards of $2,000 for gold. Is that still your view?
What I was saying last time I was on, to be a little bit more accurate, was that we thought that by 2020, 2022, we would see record high gold prices in terms of nominal annual average prices. And the nominal annual average gold price peaked around 16-something in 2012. So we're looking for prices to be well over $1,600 by 2022, but we're not looking for necessarily prices over 2,000. Now, for the annual average price to be 1650 or 1700, that means that you're going to have gold prices knocking on the door of 2,000.
Let's go ahead and move on to base metals and perhaps broaden that to commodities generally. You know, as I look at a copper chart, I see that, you know, it was about a year and a half ago that maybe it bottomed and started to base. And of course, it was right with Donald Trump's election that the huge upside happened. I thought that there was kind of a blow off there that, you know, the upside was gone. But now we're seeing just in the last few days, it looks like we're going to go retest that high. So I guess what I'm having trouble reconciling, Jeff, is it seems to me like this recovery in copper was mostly about infrastructure spending that Donald Trump intended. It seems clear to me that Donald Trump is not making a whole lot of new friends in the Congress, so I'm not sure all that infrastructure spending is really going to happen. But copper is still acting like it's completely on steroids. So is there something other than infrastructure spending perspective? And I guess you could probably broaden that to other commodities if you want as well.
Yeah, I would say that what you're seeing in copper is you're also seeing in zinc and lead and other commodities too. And our view had been that these markets probably would see higher prices despite or regardless of Donald Trump or anybody else winning the presidency. I think that the Trump election did cause some very strange speculative behavior across financial assets where there was all this bullishness about the infrastructure spending and the tax cuts, and those aren't going to happen. But we were saying from November 9th onward that we didn't expect the Trump policies to go into effect, that it was just campaign rhetoric and that he would be have his hands tied and that we wouldn't see any infrastructure spending and we might see a tax cut, but later rather than sooner. So we're not surprised by what we've seen there. I think what you're seeing in copper, lead, zinc, and other commodity industrial commodities is that the global economy is moving forward despite dysfunctional global and U.S. politics. And, you know, there is infrastructure spending, but it's not in the United States. It's in China, it's in India, it's in a host of other countries. And I think what you're seeing in base metals such as copper is the fact that the markets have realized that even though you have political problems in the United States and elsewhere, the economies of the United States, China, Europe, and a number of other countries are doing better than the financial markets had thought. So when I look at the current increase in copper, lead, zinc, and other prices, I don't necessarily see it based on the idea of a U.S. tax cut. I see it based on two things. One is the fact that the economies of the world are in better shape than the financial markets have thought they were or would be. And the other thing that I think is going on is that you have a lot of money moving into commodities from institutional investors who are concerned about the fact that, you know, they're 7 years into a bull market in the stock market and they're 8 years into a economic recovery in the United States. And there are, while things are humming along economically, there are increased probabilities of some economic downturn in the next 2 or 3 years and some decline in the stock market. So I think what you're seeing is a lot of speculative interest as well as longer-term investor interest based on fundamentals coming into these markets and pushing the prices high. That said, I look at copper, lead, zinc prices, and I say these things look too high. I think that there is speculative heat that has taken the prices higher than the fundamentals and the investment demand, the longer term investment demand would justify. So we're kind of warning our clients that, you know, this might be a good time to take some profits off of the table.
I really appreciate that answer. It makes perfect sense to me. But help me reconcile what you just said with what grain prices are doing. Because, you know, I think we, you and I agree that the industrial metals, particularly copper, maybe have a little bit too much zeal in them, a little too much excitement. But if this is a story that's about the global economy, why is it that the grains rolled back over when copper has continued to be strong?
Yeah, I haven't looked at grains as much as I'd like to, simply because people don't pay me to look at grains as much as I'd like them to. But I suspect that what you're seeing in the grain market is several things. One is a particularly good harvest in some of these things. You also have some seasonality because this is when the Northern Hemisphere harvests come in. And so you go from the bottom of the barrel because you're 9 months away from the previous harvest to the bounty of the harvest. So there's probably some seasonality in there. There's probably some pretty good harvests in there. And there may also be some demographic changes on the way people eat. But, you know, I really haven't had the time to look into grains as much as I like to.
Let's move on to a subject that I know you've done a lot of looking at because you've written about it recently. The Shanghai Futures Exchange proposes to introduce a new crude oil contract, which will be denominated in yuan, but will be convertible for the benefit of the sellers of that oil to gold. Although somehow this gold won't be Chinese gold that gets converted. I've heard so many different views about this, from it's just a sideshow, it's just propaganda, it means nothing, to this is the complete game changer that's going to change the course of history forever because the world is de-dollarizing and moving away from the dollar for payment for oil. So let's start with your high-level view. Is this the change of the future of the world, or is this crazy propaganda that doesn't mean anything?
I think it's not the change of the future of the world, and I don't necessarily think it's propaganda either. I think it's more like a sideshow and an aside. I'll throw out a couple data points. You know, first one is, you know, a few years ago, the U.S. started imposing embargoes and sanctions on Iran, and you got into this business where there was the Iranians would sell their oil to companies in Turkey. And those companies would pay the Iranians in dollars, and then the Iranian oil company, state-owned oil company, would take those dollars to Dubai and buy gold and bring the gold back into Iran because dollars were kind of worthless to them with sanctions and the animosity toward Iran of the U.S. government. So the idea that you can take your petrodollars, and that actually goes back to 1979, when the gold oil price went from $10 to $40, you had what they called petrodollar sterilization. People who sold oil were being paid in the dollars. The higher oil prices were hurting the U.S. stock market, the U.S. economy. It threw us into a recession. And so the last thing you wanted were dollars. So as you sold your oil, you got paid for it in dollars, and you bought gold. And you see that all the time, petrodollar sterilization, either into gold or into other currencies. It happened again in 2009, 2010. It's not an unusual trend. Both of those things point to something very important. If I sell you oil, or I sell you anything, I can sell you licorice, and you pay me, first off, chances are you're going to pay me in dollars because that is the currency franca of the world. I am now free to take whatever currency you've paid me in and buy gold, right? So I can always buy gold with my currencies once I've sold my product. And for the Chinese, the Shanghai Futures Exchange say, oh, well, you know, you can sell oil and be paid for it in yuan. And then you can take those yuan and buy gold. That's a meaningless statement. Right? Because they have no control over what you do with that money. What's really important is the fact to say the government says, okay, you can buy gold with those wands, but you're not going to buy gold in China. You're not going to buy gold from the Chinese government. We're not backing this deal. We're not saying that gold, that oil should be bought with gold-backed yuan. We're not saying anything like that. Central Bank is not going to supply the gold that you might buy with those yuans. And in fact, we're not going to let anybody else in China sell gold that's in China to you for those yuans. So you're free to take our currency. And if you want to buy gold, that's great. Because quite frankly, we'd rather you own gold than yuan, because we really don't want a bunch of overseas people holding enormous stashes of yuan. So it's kind of like a meaningless idea that has been blown out of proportion by people who, I guess, never studied economics in college.
So do I understand correctly what you're saying is this so-called gold convertibility of this contract? It's really like if I said, look, I'm going to hire you. Your salary is going to be $1,000 a week, but it's $1,000 that's convertible to Jack Daniels. Well, that's just because anybody who has $1,000 can buy Jack Daniels with it if they want to. You're saying there's really nothing more to it than that.
That's exactly it. You know, Eric, I think you're single. I'm going to tell you that as a single man, loose in the world, you're free to go off and find single women to date. I'm not going to help you find them. I'm not going to supply them to you. But I'm telling you that I have no problem if you go off and date some other woman. Yeah, because, hey, I actually have no control over it anyway.
So if I subscribe for a fee to the CPM Group research, that research is actually convertible to Victoria's Secret models. I just have to find a Victoria's Secret model who wants CPM Group research and cut a deal with her. That's what it comes down to. Okay. Well, I'm glad we cleared that one up, because I was going to ask you, I mean, the mechanics of this whole thing, where does the gold come from? And what you're saying is essentially that the convertibility to gold does not assure that the seller of oil is going to receive a certain amount of bullion. It's basically going to be the market value of bullion for the amount of yuan that they're being paid on that day, whatever that happens to be. There's nothing else to this contract that provides any surety or assurance in terms of a certain amount of gold being guaranteed. Let's move on now to another subject that you've written something about recently, which is the Fed chair. We've got this nomination coming up. Of course, Janet Yellen could be renominated, but Kevin Warsh sounds like maybe a more likely candidate. What do you think in terms of the outlook for who the next Fed chairperson could be, and what does it mean for markets, particularly precious metals, because it's, you know, Fed policy is so important to the price of gold, but also to the economy generally as well as other financial markets?
Yeah, well, obviously, Janet Yellen and other people might be seen as doves. Warsh might be seen as less dovish in terms of monetary policy. I'm kind of mixed minds, because one of the things that I've talked about, I don't think I've written about it lately, but the Fed at the end of the day is a human institution. And the Fed's reputation is built and torn down based on the humans that run it. So if you go back to the period, say, 1950 to 1971, when William McChesney Martin was the Fed chairman, and he was probably the greatest Fed chairman that ever lived, the Fed was seen as an incredibly austere, august, well-managed, and effective monetary manager. And during that period of time, the world suffered enormous currency crises because we were on this fixed dollar gold exchange system, which led to periodical, very sharp devaluations of fixed currency exchange rates. And the Fed did a masterful job ushering the country through the financial and monetary problems of the 50s and 60s under Martin. He retired in 71, and we had a couple of people who I won't name, but they were terrible Fed chairmen. And as a result, during the 70s, the Fed didn't handle the inflation and other problems that we faced during the 70s, but it also lost a tremendous amount of stature. So that by 1979, the Fed was often the butt of jokes. Paul Volcker came in and crushed inflation and put the Fed onto a very solid footing. And he also developed the way that we got out of the recession, the double dip recession from 1980 to 1982, which was to flood the world with liquidity, get us out of the recession, and then sell bonds and suck up that liquidity before it could have an inflationary effect. And that was the Volcker practice. And Greenspan learned it, and he used it in 1987 with the stock market crash, in 1997 with the currency crisis in Asia, 2001 with the recession. And so under Volcker and Greenspan, we had extremely well-managed Fed, and it became to be seen. I mean, people were talking about the masters of the universe and the most powerful people in Washington. And then after Greenspan, we had Bernanke and then Yellen, and they've been very inadequate Fed chairman. And the Fed has lost a tremendous amount of stature and reputation in financial markets as a result. And unless somebody that I don't see on the horizon is picked as the chairman of the Fed, I think that whoever replaces Janet Yellen will just be another mediocre Fed chairman who is not really going to help reestablish the reputation of the Fed as being the august and all-powerful body that it was under Martin and Volcker and Greenspan. So I think that concerns over who comes in as the Fed will ruffle the markets, and you'll see the usual little volatilities as people jockey, oh, it's going to be this person, it's going to be that person, he's going to be a hawk, she's going to be a dove. But I think that's largely meaningless to the bigger issue, which is that the Fed probably will continue to suffer from a diminution of respect on a global basis.
And what does that mean for gold and silver in the long run? Because it seems to me like the less credible the Fed is, it ought to weaken the dollar and therefore strengthen gold. Is that true? Does that play into your secular view on precious metals heading higher in the next few years?
It plays into it when you plug into something that we were talking about earlier, which is the continued dominance of the dollar in international currency markets. You know, I think that the fact that the Fed and the Treasury will not be seen as being particularly astutely managed is going to help undermine confidence in the long run financial management of the U.S. government and therefore the U.S. economy and inflation and the dollar. And all of that will help gold. The way it doesn't help gold is if there emerges a different country and a different central bank that can assert a greater degree of confidence. You know, you had a period of time in, say, 1994, 1996, where the Bundesbank under Karl Otto Pohl was seen as extremely well managed. And Deutschmark rose and the dollar fell and gold did nothing. But I'm not sure that you're going to see anybody step up in the ECB or anywhere else who's going to command that kind of authority. So part of our view of gold prices rising over the next 5 years is predicated on the view that there's going to be concerns about the future of monetary management in the United States and on a global basis.
If Kevin Warsh becomes the next Fed chair, presumably he is more hawkish, more inclined towards more rate hikes. Is that bearish for gold?
Yeah, presumably he is. We'll see what happens when he actually gets in there and what he does when he faces the reality of his first day on the job. But yeah, I think that a Warsh nomination would probably knock gold down $20, $30 on a short-term basis. But I think that it would be a short-term aberration, and it would wind up being the kind of buying opportunity that you saw earlier this week.
Okay, so buy the dip on the Warsh nomination, if that should happen. Let's move to our friends in the other favorite central bank, the ECB. It seems like maybe they're getting to the point where they may start to at least hint at or move toward their own quantitative tightening program at some time in the future. What is the impact for that, both generally and on precious metals, which of course are priced in dollars?
Yeah. Well, I think generally it'll be taken as a sign that the ECB views the European economy as being much more stable than it has been, and that it's now able to absorb some of this normalization process. So that should help the euro. It should hurt the dollar, and that should help gold if the dollar comes off against the euro. But I don't think that you're going to see a major move along that lines. And I think that they also are facing certain headwinds. Right now, everybody's focusing on the missteps that the British have made moving toward Brexit and the economic and financial problems that the British have probably bought themselves by committing themselves to Brexit. But I think that as time progresses, people will realize that while Brexit will be worse for England than it will be for continental Europe, it will have some negative consequences on continental Europe, which could limit the upward strength of the euro, and it could limit the optimism toward the European economy. The offset is that, you know, housing prices in the Netherlands and Paris and Frankfurt are going up very strongly because those three cities and those three economies will benefit mightily from people exiting, financial institutions exiting England and moving to those three places, and Dublin, I should say. I mean, Dublin is also benefiting greatly from this.
Let's continue on the subject of Europe generally. You know, ever since the Brexit vote, we've heard some guests tell us that it was just a flash in the pan, doesn't mean anything. Others have said, okay, it's the beginning of the end. It starts with Brexit, and exit contagion is the thing to watch for in Europe as the EU is doomed. How do you see that when something like the Catalan independence vote looks like they've declared independence, although it's a little bit vague right now as to whether that's something that's pending or actually happening? Where do you see Europe in general in 5 years? How do you see this turning out?
Yeah, you know, decentralization of political power is a very interesting thought. And it ties in, if we go back to my comments earlier, you know, a lot of people in the world would like to see a multipolar currency regime. A lot of people in the world would like to see a multipolar political economic world as well. And if you think about broad span of historic trends from the Great Depression through World War II into the 50s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s even, the overarching theme of many political developments was greater centralization of political power. So, you know, the rise of the creation of the Soviet Union, consolidation of Soviet power, China, the United States definitely consolidated power. And in Europe, you had the Rome Agreement, and you had the steady march toward ever greater centralized political and economic power. By the mid-80s, that meme was shifting, and the overarching political movement really started to be more a matter of decentralization. You had the collapse of Eastern Europe, the Eastern European Communist bloc, the collapse of the Soviet Union. You had greater decentralization in Belgium. You had the move within the United Kingdom to devolve power to Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. And the human conditions started moving toward decentralizing power. But in Europe and in some other places, the political system and the political elites continued on that now archaic march toward greater centralization. Coincidental with this was deregulation, internationalization, improved telecommunications, increased global trade, globalization, for want of a better word. And people started realizing that they didn't necessarily need political power consolidated ever more tightly in a few places. So I remember very distinctly in the 1990s when the ECB released, or it was the EMI, the European Monetary Institute, which was the precursor of the European Central Bank before 1999. The EMI issued its blueprint for how they were going to introduce a single currency. And we got this enormous document, and we started reading it, and I realized they didn't have debit cards on there, because with a debit card, you don't need a single currency. You're going to have instantaneous currency conversion. You just doesn't need, you know, computerization and globalization and deregulation and internationalization of financial markets precluded the need for a single currency by 1999. But they went ahead anyway. So now I look at Brexit as a very important move toward the political establishment facing up to the fact that the global overarching political trend is decentralization. And Catalonia, you had three states in southern Brazil vote for independence from Brazil over the weekend, and other places. All of a sudden, you're starting to see people saying, you know what, we really don't need this heavily centralized political power. We'd like to have greater political control over our lives. We'd like to have the political control that we've given to a government where I know the guy because his son plays on the same baseball team as my son. And so I look at Brexit as like a very important sign that the political system is slowly changing to reflect the political wills of the greater portion of the people. But I think it's a very slow process. I'm just flabbergasted at the way Iraq dealt with the Kurdistan vote and the way Spain is dealing with the Catalonian vote. Those governments just don't get it yet, but I think they will.
You mentioned Russia briefly in the beginning there. Let's touch on Russia. What do you see? Obviously, there's been a decay of foreign relations with the United States. At the same time, the Russian economy, there's partnership with China. Where do you see Russia going economically from here?
That's a really tough one to call because, I mean, you know, Russia had a chance in the early days of the Putin presidency to really clean up its economic act and move forward positively. But things have changed now, and it's now a thugocracy. And that severely limits the ability of people within the country to manage their own economics in a positive way. And it also severely limits the ability to attract foreign capital and foreign investors and foreign thinkers to come in and help develop those assets. And you're seeing that with Russian companies now. There are companies that really could be very interesting investments for Russians and for foreign investors, but they're not getting the capital because of the political constraints that the thugocracy or oligarchy that has arisen in the last 15 years, the constraints that oligarchy has created. And so I think Russia is, for now, consigned to being ever more of a backwater until it can turn that around. And I don't know what it'll take to turn it around.
And let's move over to China. Of course, Kyle Bass has reiterated his prediction that the just massive, massive credit expansion that China has experienced since 2008 is all going to blow up and cause horrific problems that would force a devaluation of the yuan and potentially send a wave of deflation around the world. Kyle's been saying that for a few years now and hasn't been proven right yet, which doesn't mean he's wrong, but he's certainly been early. What's your outlook for China?
China has a lot of capacity to manage its problems. It does have problems, and there are risks, and the Chinese government and Chinese leadership probably are more aware of the nature of the risks and the real nature of the risks than outside observers. But they also have a managed economy, and they have greater control over the economy than most other countries have. So, you know, you're able to see economic development and positive changes and responses to crises occurring more quickly in China than you are in other countries that have more democratic processes that require consensus building that is ever harder to find. So do they have a credit issue? Yes. Do they have a credit problem? Not yet. Will they have a credit problem? It could emerge, but I'm not convinced that it will. And it could take a long, long, long time for it to be truly problematic to the Chinese economy, given the strengths that the Chinese economy and the Chinese government and the Central People's Bank of China have built up. You know, they have quite a nice war chest, and they have some very smart people who have the capacity to respond quickly to financial and economic problems. And they have everything to lose if they fail. So they're really heavily focused on making sure that they don't upset that apple cart if they can help it. So I would not have a short-term investment predicated on the idea that the yuan's going to collapse.
You mentioned debit cards a few minutes ago. I want to come back to gold now because, you know, I think back to the 80s when Merrill Lynch introduced their cash management account. They kind of changed things. All of a sudden, you could have a brokerage account, a checking account that has a debit card attached to it. And it seems like maybe there's a new trend in the gold market. I'm not sure if it's a trend yet or not, but I think about gold money has this idea of essentially a deposit account where your savings is denominated in gold. So, you know, your balance is in gold, your statements are in gold. And then any money that you spend ends up being instantly converted electronically. So you use your debit card to, you know, buy something in France, they're going to charge you in euros. In the United States, they're going to charge you in dollars. But all of your accounting for your savings is in gold. And I guess I have two questions. One is this a trend? Do you think there are more companies beyond Gold Money that are going to be offering this kind of service? But also, is it a good idea? I mean, it seems to me like, you know, I think everybody should have gold in their portfolio. But the idea of replacing a national currency like dollars with, you know, everything is denominated in gold, I wonder about the merits of that idea. What are your thoughts?
Well, gosh, there's a lot there. Yeah. I mean, first off, on the issue of what do you denominate your wealth and your savings in? And I'm not that familiar with gold money in particular, but we're working with another company on that area. And there are a lot of other companies that are looking at various permutations of that. And we'll get back to gold first. But first, just on the idea of having some of your wealth denominated, that goes back to what I was saying earlier about currencies and, you know, the movement away from an international currency regime where the United States dollar is 62% of central bank holdings and 70%+ of private wealth to something that's more evenly distributed across currencies and gold. For that to happen, countries have to change their rules more, and they've been hesitant to do that. But you are seeing stuff. India allows people, banks to hold deposits in gold. Turkey, as of 2011, started saying to their banks, well, you have gold, dollars, and euros in your deposits as well as Turkish lira, and you can now use gold, dollars, and to meet your reserve requirements for the Turkish Central Bank. And it was a very important thing. They did it in September and October of 2011, which was when the Greek crisis was at its worst, and you had all these gold, dollars, and euros pouring into Turkey out of Europe because Europe was really looking nasty and ugly. And what the Turks did by making this change is they allowed the banks to free up Turkish liras to be lent into the Turkish market to help protect the Turkish economy from being suffering unduly because of the problems next door in Greece and in Europe. And so I think it's a good idea. I wouldn't suggest to anybody that they have all of their assets in gold because it is an illiquid and volatile currency, if you will call it a currency. But I do think that having some of your assets in gold as well as in your domestic currency and maybe a couple other currencies is a very smart thing to do, and it's hopefully wave of the future. But, you know, as I said, you know, you have to have a lot of legal and regulatory changes in a lot of countries before that becomes the norm. Plus, you have to have the market infrastructure to handle it. Plus, you have to have education of not only the providers of financial services, but the consumers of financial services to say, oh, I do want some of my money in gold. Not all of it, but some of it. So I think it's a good way. As I said, I'm not that familiar with gold money. We're working with a company called Goldex, which has a gold-denominated debit card. And frankly, those people are very astute. They're not expecting anybody to take all of their money and convert it into gold on their debit account, you know, but they think that they'll take some small portion. And they have a variety of things to do to try to help do that. So, and then there are other companies. A recent survey said that there were more than 200 companies offering gold and silver investment products online now. You know, some of them you may not want to do business with. You know, and I think there's a whole issue of how do you do your due diligence and how do you feel comfortable and get to a certain comfort level with the idea that somebody anonymous on the internet is holding gold, your wealth in gold someplace in the world for you, and sure you can get it when you need it. So I think there's a lot of infrastructure construction and marketing that needs to be done, but I do think it's a wave of things to come. If you look at the gold and silver markets right now, if you just take a look at like the silver market in the United States, you've seen a very sharp drop in gold and silver coins in the United States this year. At the same time that's happening, you've seen a big increase in ETF holdings, and you've seen a really big increase in futures and options trading volumes and open interest. So what you're seeing is people moving away from physical coins And maybe those people who wanted to have a physical coin in their own personal physical possession are saying, I'm not interested in gold and silver so much anymore. They're moving away from that collectively as an investment group, but they're moving toward increasing the gold and silver that they're holding in ETFs and futures and options. That tells you that they're much more comfortable having their assets held in a clearinghouse or a bank depository. And it also tells you that they're probably more interested in buying and selling and increasing their weight of their holdings and decreasing their weight of holdings given market conditions at any given time. So they're looking for a more tradable, flexible way to own gold and silver. And, you know, gold debit cards like Goldex is working on, that's a much more flexible way to hold it. And you're also moving away from the people who say, I buy gold and silver to stack it up in a corner against a rainy day, to people who say, I'm buying gold and silver partly to stack it up in a corner and hold it against a rainy day, but also while I'm holding it, I'd like to use it. And this is a way I can actually use it that's a little bit less cumbersome than trying to take a silver eagle down to the store to buy some milk.
Finally, Jeff, as we close, our normal policy is to ask our guests whether they have any research that we can share with our listeners. And at this particular junction, your research department at CPM Group doesn't really have anything fresh to share with our listeners. But you did recently write a custom report for Strategic Wealth Preservation, which is a precious metals outfit that operates in the Cayman Islands. And they were kind enough to give permission to allow that content to be shared with our listeners. Folks, you can find the download link in your Research Roundup email. This report is convertible to Victoria's Secret models, but at an exchange rate that you determine yourself. Jeff, tell them what they can expect and what their Victoria's Secret model can expect to find in that particular report.
Well, I think that report covers several things. First off, we talk about our short and intermediate term outlook for gold and silver. We also talk about a little bit about the platinum-palladium ratio, with palladium having moved to premium to platinum for the first time since 2001. We talk about the economic outlook as it affects gold and silver investment demand and prices. So there's a discussion about the upcoming possible changeover in the Fed chairman and what it means to the broader economy and to gold and silver. There's a discussion that we have, which is an elaboration of some work we did earlier. What happens if you add gold, silver, platinum, palladium in various amounts to a diversified portfolio of stocks and bonds? And typically what you see is the risk will fall and the returns will rise somewhat. And so we had done work on what happens if you add gold in various increments to a portfolio earlier this year. And now we've looked at it with a whole range of permutations of all four precious metals, which is a pretty interesting thing to do. And then we talk a little bit about the petro yuan and why we don't think that the petro yuan is really as big a deal as the guys who like to hammer on the dollar and say that the dollar is toast make it out to be.
Well, Jeff, I cannot thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Listeners, you can find the download link for that report for Sovereign Wealth Preservation in your Research Roundup email. Patrick Serezna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, what a fascinating interview with Jeffrey Christian. His comments about gold ranges really stuck out to me. I mean, he really defined the bottom end of his gold targets down around 1260, where those lows came in. And the first thing that came to my mind, well, is that a buy on dip opportunity? Was that like the bottom end support line? If that's the level he's talking about, what's your takeaway from it?
Well, he certainly knows a lot more about precious metals than I do, and I have a lot of respect for his opinion. So I do place a lot of credence in it. The thing is, for me, I feel like I don't have a strong conviction yet on the U.S. dollar, and I feel like gold is really dependent on the U.S. dollar. So if I was going to trade it here, I think this is a perfect example of when you use options as opposed to futures. I would consider calls on gold futures as opposed to futures outright because, you know, I'm containing my downside that way. And if I look at the implied volatilities on my options board, they're really not bad right now. So if I was going to do something here, obviously, hindsight's always 20/20. It would have been better to do it on that morning when it was 1262 or whatever the number was. But if I was going to do something, it would probably be to buy calls on gold as opposed to futures outright.
Well, I have to agree with that because at this moment, while selling a premium down below on gold is a no-brainer at a support level, the thing is implieds are not very high, which means that you're getting on, at least on a relative basis, on the lower end of premium return for selling. But you can still make some good premiums selling, put credit spreads and things like that below. But really with the low volatility, implied volatilities in gold, I'd have to say that expressing a bullish view with the option on the upside with call options is an interesting thing because if gold goes higher, you've got a pretty good entry off the bottom end of the range. And if we're early and the US dollar takes off and gold is still suppressed and turns out going back down, your risk was just defined by the cost of the call. So I kind of like that strategy here. Nonetheless, I wanted to move on because you wanted to talk about some crude oil, extended crude oil coverage. And I was just wondering what was on your mind.
Well, I think we've got some really excellent content linked for our oil fans in this week's Research Roundup. You've got an excellent article from Art Berman, linked to his blog. Art is saying, get ready for higher prices coming. Meanwhile, our friend Raul Paul over at Real Vision has a new video out, which is an update to one he did about 4 or 5 months ago. And he's got a very bearish view. And he's got Peter Brandt, who's a very well-respected chartist, who's saying that this high we just had at 52.88 looks like a right shoulder on a head and shoulders pattern, which has a downside target in the 20s. So, you know, two totally different views. How do you reconcile them? And I think in terms of my perspective, I'll talk about each one of them separately. Let's start with Raul's video. I do agree that everything I'm seeing suggests that we are at kind of a top here. I think that for the rest of this year, let's say through Christmas time, my view is bearish. Now, how far down is the price going to go? I don't really have a target in mind because we've seen more upside here than I was expecting, and you know we'll see what happens. But I do agree with the bearish view in terms of fundamentals. I put kind of a pause on that because we are seeing drawdowns in inventory continuing even when seasonally you would expect to see building of inventory. Now, that's definitely happening because of exports. That's where it's going. If you look just at this week's numbers, for example, we had a drawdown in crude oil inventory. But if you look at the export number this week, it was 1.27 million barrels. That's per day. So if you times 7, that's 8.9 million barrels of oil that was exported. If exporting oil was still illegal like it used to be, then that 2.7 million barrel drawdown would have been a 5 point something million barrel build on inventory. So I think that it's a little bit of an illusion, but still the market is going to be affected by those drawdowns on inventory. And I think that's going to maybe soften the downside view. So where I would have previously agreed completely with Raul's, at least in the short to intermediate term, the bearish view, I think maybe that idea of prices in the 20s is a little bit too pessimistic in terms of what we're seeing with inventory. On the other hand, the place where I really have to disagree with Raul and some of his guests is they see this as a much longer term phenomenon than I do. I think what's going on is peak cheap oil is still very real. We are going to see much, much higher oil prices as we end up paying the price for all of this lack of investment in production capability. Shale has been this fantastic flash in the pan, but a flash in the pan still the same. It was fueled by easy money from the Federal Reserve. Those policies are changing now. And even if you look at some of the information that exists in the industry, they're really saying that, you know, the Permian is all that's left. The Bakken doesn't have the kind of new drilling opportunities that it used to. Shale is not played out yet, but it's going to play out eventually. And when it does, the next increment incremental source of oil production is deep water offshore, and that is a place where the assets that are needed to do that work have all been depreciated. You've seen a lot of rigs going out of service that are no longer available because the economics haven't been there for the last 4 or 5 years to do that kind of operation. They can't just turn all that stuff back on. There's a lead time there. So we're going to see, I think, does it start, as Art Berman thinks, by the first of the year, or does it start in the end of 2018? I'm not sure, but at some point, we're going to see much higher oil prices. The place where I don't think Raoul's video really captures, and I suppose the reason is because his view is bearish longer term. I think if you have the view that I have, which is that it is bearish at least through the end of this year, but maybe it becomes bullish after that, the real story, I think, is not in the front month price, but in the term structure. Last time when we got down to $26 oil prices, it seemed like, oh my gosh, that was just the buying opportunity of a lifetime. It really wasn't. And the reason is that the contango was so steep that if on that day when we saw $26 front month prices, if you wanted to make the longer term trade by the 2020 or 2021 futures, those were still above $50, double what the front month was because of that immense contango. What we're seeing is a change in the market structure to where you have backwardation in the middle of the curve now. And if that persists, as a lot of people are expecting it will, even as prices come down for the rest of this year, I doubt that we're going to get that $26 low again. Peter Brandt thinks we're going to get back to approximately the same level. I'll be surprised if we do. But I do think there's a very good chance that the 2020 contract, which it traded really only traded below $47 for like 2 days. It got down to $44, but it was $44.50, I think. That was just a very temporary spike. Only a few contracts changed hands at those low numbers. It really, from a practical standpoint, never in a meaningful way traded below about $46. I think we are going to go well below that before this year is out. And if you have the longer-term bullish view, which I do, I think your opportunity to buy those long-dated futures will actually be better than it was back on the day when we recorded that $26 low on the front month price. So that's my reaction to Raoul's video. Now, what Art Berman is saying is, and remember, Art is the guy who, when everybody else was saying $80 in oil is coming, a year ago or whatever, Art was saying, look, folks, I live in the real world driven by data, not by hyperbole. I look at the data. We've got this building of relative inventory that traditionally has always made prices go lower, not higher. You people that think $80 is coming, you're nuts. So Art is the guy who's been bearish recently. And again, he's being data driven. He's saying, look at the amount of inventory drawdown that has occurred this year. And yes, a lot of it is because of the Brent WTI spread. A lot of it is because of the legalization of exports. There's a lot of ways to explain it. But at the end of the day, that oil is no longer in inventory. And even at a time right now, seasonally, when you would expect inventories to be building, they're still drawing down. And Art is saying, hey, we're going to get back to historically normal inventory levels, and that's going to allow the price to appreciate. He has an excellent graph where he shows visually, doesn't make that much difference at first, but there's kind of an inflection point. And as we get significant more drawdowns in inventory, assuming that's what happens, it's going to cause the price to appreciate quickly. He makes an excellent argument for that. So I'm sure that Art's going to be proven right. Now, I thought that the Art Berman argument, the essence of it, something I expected to happen in the second half of 2018. He's saying first quarter of 2018. I'd love to get him back on the program to get an update on this because I'm really curious what he's basing that on, if it's just a linear projection of this inventory trend or if he's seasonally adjusting it or what have you. And I want to continue to watch this trend in exports very closely because we saw this just massive explosion of exports. That is the reason inventories are being drawn down. It's not because of changing supply-demand dynamics. It's because of exports. Well, the exports went through the roof right after the hurricane, and they also were fueled in part by the Brent WTI spread. So is the Brent WTI spread going to come back and narrow to its historical or recent historical norms? And if so, is that going to slow this rate of inventory drawdown? If that happens, how does Art feel at that point about his prediction of this happening in the first quarter? I'd love to get his perspective perspective on that. So I think Art is definitely right. I think he may be early, yet remains to be seen. I think Raoul's video is definitely right in the very short term. Longer term, I tend to go more with Art's view. Meanwhile, Patrick, in the short term, the big question that's on my mind is this downdraft that we're seeing now. You know, do we put in the high for this cycle at 52.88, or is there potentially another push higher? I'm showing, you know, it looks really good to me that we're going to get down to 48.40 to 48.60. But are we going to keep going down from there, or is there going to be another push higher? I know you've been looking at that with some of your members at BigPictureTrading.com. What are your thoughts?
For me, I'm really looking at the Fibonacci levels on this pullback. We were anticipating after that last push up to that kind of upper end of toward $53 to be a retracement. At this stage, the way I'm looking at the trade here is that so long as we structurally stay at or above this kind of 49 level, I mean, there could be temporary prints below 49, but so long as we're staying above that level, I'm still looking for another leg higher in crude to come either retest those kind of levels around 53 or maybe even potentially make a push up to $54+ to the top end of where all those highs were. And once we get up there, that's where I was going to start exploring the idea that there's going to be big overhead resistance or not. But I actually am still not convinced that the big downturn in oil is underway. So Eric, I just want to move on here because Hoisington Investment Management came out with their quarterly review for the third quarter of 2017. And I absolutely love Lacey Hunt's work. And when this came out, that's my favorite read out there. And so I just soaked this up yesterday when it was released. And I felt that we should really talk about it because we've had guest after guest after guest talking about inflation and the fear of inflation coming into the market. And over the last several decades, Lacey Hunt has been very consistent at looking at low growth, low inflation, lower interest rates. The secular lows of interest rates are not in. That narrative is pretty consistent. And I wanted to just take some of the excerpts out of that report and just discuss them because it's really interesting to see that counter perspective to everything we've been hearing with so many of our other guests. And so he starts off the report by saying the worst economic recovery in the post-World War II period will continue to be restrained by consumer sector burdened by paltry income growth, a low and falling savings rate, and an increasingly restrictive Federal Reserve policy. Additionally, with extremely high levels of U.S. government debt and deteriorating fiscal situation, the economy is unlikely to benefit from any debt-financed tax changes. Finally, from a longer-term perspective, the recent natural disasters are an additional constraint on economic growth. And he goes on later on to say, though, that clearly consumer spending is a crucial component to maintaining growth in GDP. And consumer spending is funded by either income growth, more debt, or some other reduction in savings. Recent trends in each of these categories, as outlined below, did not bode well for this critical sector of the U.S. economy. And so when I hear him saying this, I kind of ask the question, where really is inflation going to come from?
Well, Patrick, I ask myself the same question all the time. Where is it going to come from? And I just want to be honest. I don't know the answer. And that's why it's very interesting to me. I love Lacey Hunt, as you said. Of course, we do have this report that we're discussing linked in this week's Research Roundup for our registered users. So you can find the download link there. I love Lacey Hunt's work, and I love reading it, and it's always very interesting to me. My strong view on inflation is this. Nothing is forever. There's going to be inflation someday. When we start to get a runaway problem with inflation, whether that's next month or 10 years from now, I have no idea. When it happens, it's going to be a really big deal. And I think if you want to know what could cause a wholesale loss of faith in central bankers, it's when the market wakes up and says, wait a minute, if we really have a runaway inflation problem, that ties the central bankers' hands. They can't use accommodative monetary policy in order to get us out of the next pickle because doing that would exacerbate the inflation, lead to a hyperinflation. Oh my gosh, they're in a corner they can't get out of. So someday when we get really, really big runaway inflation, it's going to be an absolute game changer. I'm convinced of that. I'm glad to see that, at least according to Lacey Hunt, who's very, very knowledgeable on this, that he doesn't think is in the cards at all, although we've certainly had some other very credible guests who think it is. So I think it's very important to watch the subject. I don't have a strong opinion on when it's going to happen. I do have a very strong opinion that when it does, it's going to be real trouble.
No, and you know what? He goes on and he actually talks about the Fed inside the report as well. And he was basically talking about this idea that, look, I mean, rate hikes are coming and they continue to do quantitative tightening. He makes the comment saying that the massive balance sheet expansion recorded during the three separate QE programs did not produce any significant growth in the money supply, the M2, or in nominal GDP, despite the predictions of many to the contrary, right? He goes on, though, to say that in the expansion, which has been the slowest in this post-World War II period, thus it was perceived, and the Fed has assured the public that a modest reduction in the balance sheet will only have a benign impact on the economy. It goes on to say that this presumed symmetry in the monetary actions may exist in certain economic circumstances, but in a heavily indebted society, the Fed actions are actually highly asymmetric. And so what we have is Lacey Hunt basically saying that he actually thinks that the Fed raising here and actually starting to reduce their balance sheet is going to have an increasingly big impact on it. And so when we ask the question as to where a potential next recession may rear its head, clearly Lacey Hunt believes that it's the Fed and their tightening policy that is actually going to ultimately be a catalyst. What I thought was interesting, he concluded with his belief that the yield curve will invert, that literally we'll see short rates rising, long-term rates declining as inflation expectations drop, and we'll see an inversion, which often leads to a recession. And I thought that was such a really interesting insight from Lacey.
Well, and I think the key to that, Patrick, is we're in uncharted territory here. You know, we've never been through anything close to this kind of monetary policy experiment in recorded history of the world. So, you know, this is the big question. What everybody said, the critics of quantitative easing said, when you try to unwind this thing, it's going to get ugly. Well, now we're at the very beginning of the unwind, and I would certainly be the first to admit, I thought as soon as we got to the tapering part and you just stop adding more liquidity to the system, that that's when things were going to get really tough. And it hasn't really happened yet. You know, you look at the markets just thundering higher. I don't think it makes any sense. So is that recession going to happen? Is quantitative tightening going to trigger it? I think probably a bigger question in my mind is, you know, look, we're probably not going to see a renomination of Janet Yellen from President Trump. That means a new personality for the Fed chair. And that is potentially a game changer. We don't know. You know, Jeff Christian gave us some perspective on what some of the potential choices might be and how they would fare for markets. Until we know who the choice is, we're not really going to know what it means. And each new Fed chair kind of brings a new personality to the overall functioning of the Fed. So I think that's a big wild card. But before we close, Patrick, you've also got linked in the Research Roundup email some charts showing volatility patterns for S&P 500 futures. What's on your mind there?
We've talked actually a lot about the S&P 500 and often many of the option strategies associated. And I just find it absolutely fascinating seeing where we are, not only from a historical volatility perspective in the S&P 500, but also in where we are in terms of the implied volatility in the markets today. So the first chart that our listeners will find in that little chart book we attach is looking at the historical volatility for 30 days, 100 days, and 200 days on the SPYs, which are the ETF for the S&P 500. And what's fascinating to me, this is a three-year chart, and we're seeing the lowest levels of 30-day, 100-day, and 200-day historical volatility or real volatility in the markets. And that's actually probably, if you go back to since the great financial crisis back in there, this is probably the lowest levels of volatility trends that we have seen. And that's reflective of today's implied volatilities, which when you look at the second chart, you can see the trend of what implied volatilities have been doing on the October, November, December, and January options. Now, obviously, they are supposed to be downwards trending because longer-term options tend to have to price higher implieds, and as they get closer to expiration, they gravitate lower. But really looking at the last 3 months, you know, go back to the summer until now, we have really seen an implosion on implied volatilities in the market on the S&P. It's never been cheaper on a relative basis to actually express trades with options in the markets. Now, there are still vol skews. Put options are more expensive than calls. But, you know, I asked the question openly. You know, we've debated before, and I've shared with our listeners many times in the past how much I hate straddles, because you pay double the premium, only one leg is going to be right, and therefore reduces the risk-reward proposition and the overall profitability of the trade. But for the first time, I'm really kind of asking the question, is this an interesting moment in the markets to actually implement a straddle? Because either really the Martin Armstrong scenario of a melt-up could happen, but at the same time, this complacency that we see in the market, everyone has gone from being so worried about a market decline back in August to now everyone really starting to become super complacent. Volatility is so compressed and nobody seems to be worried about anything. And all I know is that usually these kind of periods have explosive volatility trends that eventually come about. But what's your thinking here, Eric?
Well, I agree with you on that opportunity. I'm glad you brought it up. And I'd say we need to distinguish here. There's a couple of different ways that people use straddles. Sometimes people just buy straddles, not so much because they're expecting the market to move in one direction or the other in a big way, but because volatility is very low, a straddle is essentially a proxy for buying volatility itself. So if implied volatility goes up because of increasing perception of risk, even if the market doesn't move, you can make money on that strategy in theory, except you and I are both pretty darn skeptical of that strategy. Frankly, I'm still skeptical of that strategy for reasons we've discussed in other shows. On the other hand, if you look at a straddle from the perspective of, hey, this market's either going to melt up our Martin Armstrong style, or it's going to roll over and crash, but it's definitely not going to just stay flat right here at 25.50 for the next 6 months, then you want to just play that, you know, it's one way or the other. It's going to do one thing or the other thing. This is an awfully cheap time to be buying that optionality because the implied vol is so low. Your cost of buying that optionality premium is very low. And I cannot, for the life of me, articulate a reason why the market would just cruise along at this arbitrary number of 25.50 and stay here for the next 6 months. I think we're going several hundred points in one direction or the other, because either the mania continues, and I do think it's a mania to the upside, or reality sets in finally and we see a dramatic reversal to the downside. So I like the idea of straddles here. But on that note, we should wrap things up because we are out of time once again. Folks, we really appreciate your help. The donations we've been receiving are probably going to make it possible for us to release the rest of Eurodollar University early instead of using it for our holiday shows as we'd originally planned. We're working on producing some new content, and your donations are making that possible. So thanks to everyone who has donated. If you are able to do so, there's a donate button on the homepage at macrovoices.com, and we tremendously appreciate your support in helping us to defray our production costs. Most importantly, though, please register your free account at macrovoices.com. It costs you nothing. It gives us that statistic of how many registered users we have, which is the single most important bargaining chip Patrick has when he's negotiating to get the very best feature interview guests on the program. You can register for free at macrovoices.com. It only takes a few minutes. We're not going to spam you. We're not going to sell your email address. All we're going to do is send you the free research roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all of the coolest free stuff we could find, as well as downloads from our feature interviewed guests, such as that SWP report that you got from today's interview with Jeff Christian. Patrick, tell them what else they can find in this week's research roundup.
All right. Well, this week, you're going to obviously find the transcript for today's interview with Jeffrey Christian. You'll also find the link to that volatility chart on the S&P 500 that Eric and I discussed in the postgame. You'll find a link to that Art Berman oil article that we were referencing during our extended oil coverage, and as well as a link to the download for Lacey Hunt's quarterly report for discussing all of these outlooks about inflation expectations and growth. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.